part of the world, and there is a lot of changes and transition time that has occurred where Dharma is practiced in all different ways. So the structure of how they are related to practice in the modern world, the shape that it has taken, is really about 40 or at the most 50 years old. And before that, if you look at the, you know, right from the 15th century, and then we go backwards to the time of the Buddha into the time of Mara Rinpoche, we will find that this part of that and the fruition generated from that has always come from long engagement with the Dharma. Throughout the history, you never find incidents or anecdotes or examples of bodhisattvas and great masters whom we have great devotion to, right? And we find in our lineage and American practices, never really actually attempt to realize action half-heartedly. And so you don't find them ever saying, like, I tried my best, or that I've had to juggle samsara and mana both and I succeeded in doing that, or that they were part-time engaged in the path of the practices, and, you know, through that they got the realization. We only find that these great masters whose steps we try to follow have engaged in practices fully, not half-heartedly, not when they had time to do so, and especially not when they retired. So that's I'm always trying to sort of joke with many of you who are always trying to retire and then do some practices after retirement. Anyway, so you never see that. You find them fully engaged, body, speech, mind, you know, absolutely change their life, dedicate their heartedly to the path of practice, and spend numerous years, large part of their life, doing practice. And these are all traditional masters who are born as, you know, within the human world, but having purified all their negativities in a merit, these are great emanations, as mentioned, of Vajrakara, as mentioned, of Vajrasattva, emanations of Padmasambhava, emanations of Manjushri, emanations of many different great patterns and realized masters. And it, so as I was saying, even great realized masters, you know, have spent 20 years in their practice and sleep. And if we find, you know, teachers that we know, whose first gift is the latter part of life, spend so much time in retreat, His Holiness Rinpoche General Rinpoche, our root guru, spent no less than almost 90 years in retreat. And so when they are great emanations, incarnations of great masters, you have to sometimes think, if each one of you were recognized as an emanation of Guru Rinpoche or Manjushri, and you held the title of teacher, and you were teaching, practicing, and, you know, leading great examples, then if it was our, then you really don't have to go into the tree. Your mind would already be able to balance both Sara and. But our teachers, our teacher tried who they were, whose emanations, the great emanations that they were, still found it necessary to really practice retreat. And therefore, the value of retreat and the importance of retreat has to be understood by modern day masters teachers and practitioners. Of course, each one of you have your own size and responsibilities. And so today we've come to a situation where some are very fortunate and are at a juncture in their that they can really engage more and more in Dharma and in fact. And I think, on a tangent, I would say, as many of you are beginning to live on the land and practice and be more involved in, you know, being part of the sangha, there is a tendency sometimes to look for God in sangha. And that's where you come up with your very, you know, common statement that you all make. What's my place in sangha? What's my place in business? And you know, that is a very wrong thing. If you have been entrusted with a certain responsibility, of course, based on that responsibility, one has to serve as one can, if one wishes to do so, if one has the capability and the ability to do so. That's simply very meritorious. But that is secondary. The first is, we're all practitioners, and therefore, your in the sangha is as a retreat, is as a practitioner, somebody who has come to a very fortunate state in your own life where you're able to now not only be inspired by the great masters and aspire to follow their example, but you actually are engaging in following that aspiration that you held in your heart for all these numerous years. And so, those of you who are fortunate enough in your life, able to now do more practice, do more routine, need to really recognize this precious opportunity and to really dedicate life to retreat, to practices. And then, second group of people who are not in that position in their life, even they may have family, they're all. Many things so really possible for. And so for that, the urban bridge, as we are calling it, I think is very good to try and put in much more effort than you have been doing. So collecting time to do the shorter bridge so that every quarter of a month or every year, maybe four times, or how many ever times that we can actually do is to take time out and to engage in intensive practice and retreat. This becomes very important because it's now for many years that many of you have been listening to teaching and receiving numerous empowerment teaching, studying on your own, been blessed with kindness and wisdom of many teachers. And so, very essentially, we now begin to really work with that practice so that there is no discrepancy happening between view and meditation. There is a very danger that I'm today becoming more and more aware of, and that is the expansiveness or the growth, the great increase. In the intellectual knowledge of the Dharma, which I think participated by each later by express. So you've all become very good at expressing Dharma to yourself and to others. But if the intellectual understanding of the Dharma is only expressed through speech and through intellectual then it may not really be completely powerful to become a taste of experience, because the taste of experience is completely upon meditating, to really meditate on it, to ponder on the change, to analyze the actual experience is very, very important. And therefore, as one practices, whether it is lifelong retreat whether it is an urban retreat program, which you're all going through now, and even from a general perspective of relating to the Dharma and practice path. It's very important that meditators have a powerful foundation of extended intensive practice where you are able to fully merge your mind with the essence and the meaning of the Dharma. So now, from that perspective, when you are in a state where you're able to engage wholeheartedly Dharma, then that is a little bit different from how we normally practice within a situation where we are busy engaging in different activities. For example, one may do morning practices, one may through the day recite mantra or remain mindful, one engages in as much as possible pure heartedness and engage in virtual activity. Many of you are dedicated to hearing some practices or whatever other practices that you are doing. You may be doing for evening prayers and prayers and different kinds of aspirations. But if these different practices and contemplation and study of the Dharma are being done while part of your mind and attention is submerged in really active mundaneness. And so we may try to remain very mindful. We may try to really our connection with the meaning and purpose of the people. But realistically, what of us know how powerful the different busy activities are, and they draw our attention towards them. Our concentration is submerged within all of all these activities. And so there is a constant struggle of trying to retain the meaning of the Dharma and yet being sort of pulled in different directions because you're trying to make sense of both what Dharma is trying to introduce our mind to as well as making sense of everything else that you are engaged. And so the concept is there which makes all of us extremely tired. And so when people say, oh, I'm very overwhelmed with Dharma, or I find Dharma very complicated, or this is too much for me. When one feels very, very overwhelmed by the Dharma, most oftentimes you'll have to see that it's not the Dharma practice that's overwhelming. It's great conflict between Dharma and the pull of our habitual tendencies, the pull of dizziness of our senses, the pull of our still prolonged sort of attachment to all activities. And so when you're pulled in this direction, you're struggling with, then of course, very, very normal that people feel very tired and very sort of overworked or exhausted and overwhelmed. And so it's very important for meditators to recognize that, well, if we sustain this, then, you know, our relationship with ignorance and samsara is so long, and it's so familiar that most oftentimes they're not fully explained samsara and they're full of samsara. Of course, our basic mind being wisdom in essence, it does recognize that this is not probably a right position or a right thought. But nevertheless, we will negate that message of the wisdom. And we are very inclined to sort of give samsara and the fruit of samsara and distraction and ignorance the benefit of doubt. So what happens? Very convenient to blame Dharma as not being relevant to our life. Something that maybe actually more selfish to do because the kinder thing is to respond to samsara at this moment. So you begin to come up with all kinds of reasoning on why the pull towards the happiness of the samsara is not more necessary or being And that's how the time passes. And each year, we experience the different struggles that we feel. And so that's the sort of love-hate relationship that we have with the Dharma. You know you can love it, but at the same time, can't love it. You know samsara is not into love, but at the same time, you feel tremendous love for it. It's a very sort of a difficult situation, and it's a passage of time because you're seeing this. Then, of course, at some point, you're going to break down. You're going to have to break down completely, and that's a very painful place to be in. So, recognizing this, senior students and the younger students. Senior students more so because of having direct basis. And the younger is knowing that this is possibly that we will encounter. Therefore, it is very important to allow one to really have a much more practical and direct relationship, dedicated relationship to the practice part. And that can only happen, so we all are, and most of you are household. So this can only be defeated, and the struggle can be defeated, or avoided, or at least decreed by understanding that it is a path that will require and is very dedicated to your own self, and allowing your own self to have a much more deeper experience of meditation, which is very necessary. And so, on those nights that we are going into what we call retreat, and retreat here, therefore, to actually retreat from, or to go away from, retreat from that struggle of feeling the pull between samsara and dharma, and to allow your a period of time, whether it is 5 days, a week, whether it is a few months, to give yourself time to actually experience what your intelligent mind recognizes through the teachings of the transmission, receives wholeheartedly part of the practices, so that during that at least you're not faced with the struggle of having to simply balance distractions of mundane activity and your devotion and love for the Dharma practice. That's what it's all about. And therefore, it's very important to keep that perspective while being in retreat. So, when people say, I do not have the financial resources or the time to come and do retreat at Lotus Garden or wherever it is, I fully understand. But on the other hand, why this is secondary talk? And the first is only to emphasize being in a retreat, is because the struggle that you feel between activity and what you're familiar with, the responding that you have to constantly give to or to be sort of aware of the response to mundane activity, is just very, very strong in those environments where you're very familiar. And so some people may be able to do that, but many times it's very difficult. Therefore, to come to a place where you are not going to so susceptible to the sort of magnetic pull of all the habitual things and the mind review like through is going to constantly sort of lead you to understanding that, and therefore knowing why going to a or even if you're individually to keep a very strong discipline of practice where you are able to free yourself from that pull that you put, the busyness of the different activities and distractions, and to give yourself time and space and this quietude and the environment of intensive meditation is very important. Now, when you are in and you have created the ground so that you are alone, that you are silent, that you're now ready to go through the experience of meditation, sense of meditation, then here then what is essential is to leave behind all old familiar bodies that can actually be disruptive to allowing your mind to have a very regular of samadhi and meditation. Therefore, determination of observation retreat is very important. In the traditional teaching, it is said that when you go in and you enter into the retreat, there has to be a determination that come what may. Even if it is death that I face, I am not going to compromise my meditation. I am going to not be distracted and fully engage wholeheartedly into the essence of Dharma and realize. And so with that kind of information, not to sort of bat and forth with the motivation, determination to practice, one must engage into the practice. And especially during the period of time that you are practicing. Now this is generally during all kinds of meditative practices, but particularly when you are engaging in intensive practice, it's very, very to always know that what you are doing is a skillful method. Whether it is home meditation, or just Monroe or yoga practice, whether it is home rest meditation, shamatha, or any other kind of meditations that you may be doing, know that these are all skillful methods, very powerful, skillful methods that create the boundaries, that strengthen the base, that protect you, and guide you into most important what you are trying to do to your practice. And that is introduce, giving yourself the chance to introduce yourself to your own private domain. And so, outer silence, the discipline, the support of the discipline must lead the mind to really meet and introduce your own self with a very primordial nature and principle of one's own self. And that secret is a sense of seeing why you are doing all these practices, the skillful methods of different practices that you're engaging in. That's very, the very core base of yourself is vast, expansive, spacious, skylight. And that is what the ground. Here in this ground, there is no rhythm to follow. There is no form to see. There is no movement to engage in. There is nothing to describe. There is nothing that comes or goes. The basic nature doesn't require any movement or any form to be articulated by one's own senses. One sees the different kinds of forms, but beyond that, the basic nature is like the sky, like the empty sky that holds within its womb all kinds of forms, but the form is not the space. In the same way, the basic nature is the space, and forms that come are all in its depth. Has no form. All kinds of sounds, also like the fluttering of clouds in the expanse of the sky, there are some, but the basic nature is completely free, unattached to the sound. And in that way, all senses and all the activities of the various senses appear, rises, abides, ceases. But the basic nature is free from being a sound, being a form, being a taste, being a smell, being a texture, or being expressed by thought. So all of these activities of the senses are there. As long as we are alive, senses are active, and they're always not deterred in your meditation, not being deterred by the senses activities, but going deeper into knowing that the whole nature is absolutely expansive, quiet, and rested. And so the first point is through, as you pursue with this skillful method, introduce yourself to the basic nature, the sustenance of which is not dependent upon articulation by the senses. Recognizing it simply means you have to almost tell yourself, well, that's how it is, that's what the basic nature is. Now, all the big deal that we face, big deal of false reality, big deal of the sound here, big deal of the thoughts that occur in our mind, big deal that we make of our personalization, big deal that we make with the problems and the fears that we have, big deal we make with our agenda, big deal that we make with our results, big deal that we make the effort. You know, all that, all those are faith that arises in the expansiveness of the space. And like the wisp of smoke, it arises. And if you let it be, there's nothing more for it. And therefore, while enjoying and seeing the many different kinds of shapes and forms that does occur in the field of our senses, yet the very core nature is not bound by that. It is not dependent on these. And therefore, recognize it as being able to see how much we tend to conjure the importance of our senses activity, while very basic core nature of mind has nothing to do with it or does not have any value associated with whatever is right. And so recognize being able to tell yourself, you know, I've spent so much time and energy thinking that what my senses are trying to pass, all the hope and fear is a big deal. I've made it so important, while it seems that the very core nature is there is no birth, there is no death. You know, there's nothing that really is beyond what my mind thinks to be more important or necessary. Recognizing what leads to state, the third state, which is usually called a state of wonderment. It's just being sort of struck. A yogi, a meditator, is really just struck by how foolish we have been. You know, when you recognize, you introduce your own self to your nature, when you recognize, and then you're able to that recognition, see the very big difference, the contrast that is there between what we thought and what is. And we're struck by the one of how stupid we've been, how foolish we've been. That everything is very basic nature. Everything that we've made, we've made important. Everything that we've tried to, belittle is mind's own inability to rest and create storylines and make a big drama of everything. And so we are struck by wonder. The yogi, the meditator, is struck by wonderment. Wonderment at how ignorant we've been. Wonderment and being amazed by this stark contrast between nature as is and everything that we have conjured, deliberated with, and created. And so for a long period of time, the retreatant must work with. And that's where many of our great yogis and masters, I think at this point, have created great poetry a state struck by the amazement and the wonderment of the contrast between the basic nature and what we have created. I think that's where most of our pointing out instructions and the yogi dohas and great poetry, such as Milarepa's dohas, Shankara's dohas, you know, have all evolved. Is where struck by the amazed by ignorance of sentient beings, unable to understand the simplicity of their own nature, great bodhisattvas, masters, and mahasiddhas have tried to warn us through their teachings and through their composition on what is the true nature and how, not recognizing it, we have just created this immense many causes of samsara. And so, when this wonderment and the amazement of samsara that we've created, and in contrast, the very simple nature that doesn't require any of it understood, then the wonderment leads to longing to sustain the state. And therefore, the fourth state is familiarization, which arises from yearning and longing to sustain the space, the quietness of one's own basic nature. And therefore, when a lamp is sort of blown by the gust of wind, and a person tries to protect the flame by covering it both on palms, quite similar to that example, is you want to protect your mind that sustains the state of equanimity, silence, and simplicity. It is in that moment of yearning and longing to familiarize and to be more united with your own nature, because by now you know all the distractions that need that are so strong in just again leading you to a state of sort of being completely immersed within the creation, the unceasing creation of one's own sort of attachment to the sense of activity. And at that time, one begins to, from one's heart, pray, supplicate, and practice. So the hands that protect the flame, they are the prayer, are the supplication, and the daily practice. And so, you know that if you do not practice, if you do not supplicate, gusts of winds of habitual passion and the distractions of samsara are strong enough to blow out the very basic quietude and spaciousness of one's own fundamental nature. And so the natural discipline of one's own prayer application arises from a mind that recognizes how much more it can be protected, so that you have introduced yourself at just limits can be sustained to become an unbroken chain of equanimity, quietude. And so, if this is really understood, if a person works with, then mati and patience, which is brought together and kept together, is able to be, I think, truly be virtuous and beneficial for everyone. So like your mala, look at your mala and you see the many beads. Each bead leads to the other bead that counts the number of beads on your mala. But you cannot count if the thread doesn't keep all the beads together. So each bead identical to the next. In the same way, when you introduce yourself as recognizing your own basic nature, the nature is pervasive. each moment has to enter into another moment that leads you to an unknown scene of familiarization of with your own being. But until one is able to fully gain efficiency and naturalness that abides with its basic nature, you will have to bind all the modes of awareness with the thread of practice, the skillful means that you have entrusted with. And so, with the practice, the skillful method, in one moment is the next moment too. But each moment, with introspection, with really researching, analyzing, going deeper into one's own self, introducing yourself to the basic nature, the mind of the meditator, then realize that everything is circumstantial. You're doing everything, whether you're sitting and meditating, that's a method. If you're not doing anything particular, that's also a method. All engaged activity or virtue, that's also a method. Mundane activities that you are engaged in, it's also a method. But beyond that, the very basic primordial nature, that is your own basic nature, is completely free without the need of any projections or deliberation to sustain it. Confidence of then knowing and seeing your own nature as you build up, as you work with your with the confidence of facing that own basic nature. Such a meditation, such a retreat, no longer can struggle with anything. Struggle of practice, struggle with samsara, attachment to samsara, and attachment to dharma, everything will then fall apart because the confidence of knowing your own basic nature makes you realize that everything that we try to keep our mind busy with are actually just projections. They are just like a mirage, like a dream. And so if they are like a mirage, projection of one's own mind, then why make it so very important? All that we want to hope, why make it so very important? It's nature. It doesn't survive, it doesn't sustain itself on that hope. Hope is just a drama that they create. Neither the fear we have, fears of our problems, fears of our inability, fears of not being better. Basic nature has no fear. Basic nature is just openness, just spaciousness, just clear and open. Where the basic nature doesn't require it, yet we try to keep our fear very common. That's like making a big deal of the dream that we had last night. And so, when we are foolish enough to make a mirage, a dream, a storyline, very real and very powerful, that's where we step up to the distractions and to the ignorant one. A meditator will say, but fear is also just a mind conjuring of an idea. Basic nature has no fear. And therefore, in retreat, as you familiarize yourself, as you see this, a natural confidence of the basic nature arises, and you increase your warmth, you try to sustain it in an unbroken chain with mindfulness, with awareness. And that confidence of being able to remain inseparable from your gradually and agitation decreases the hope of all that we have endured, the hopes and the fears and the distractions that we have endured, that we have made so very important. Non-attachment, being aware, non-aggression, being patient, being able to really have single faces of all experiences. These are the natural results that come from being able to recognize and have more confidence of the basic nature. The basic nature that gets to free from the sort of mistaken view of thinking the projection to be very important. So in this way, however, as I said earlier, such depth of experience who are always going to be very exposed to experience. If every 15 minutes, if every half an hour, if every hour in every day, you are in a situation which is going to call you to make sense of them. And so while in daily life, and when we are in the middle of samsara and all that, there's always something that's going to ask you to hope and fear very real. And so that sort of a sense of trying to make real of that all hope and fear, which we call responsibility, and the little glimpse of basic nature, and the contrast, and trying to sort of balance the contrast of both of these, I think, are something that is always going to struck one's path of enlightenment. And yet, this which happens very, very easily while in the midst of samsara and different activities. But in retreat, it's very different. You can sustain your sense of action and glimpse of the basic nature without the constant pull of the need to be responsive to the different activities and calls of hope. And so here is a moment in retreat, a breathing moment that is yourself that allows you to really sustain the basic nature a little bit more. And until you are not able to sustain the glimpse of one's own basic nature, the lack of confidence, therefore, will always, I think, make it very difficult for us to connect with attachment to trust. And where attachment to trust is strong and we're not able to cut through it, then no matter how much we work hard and how much devotion we may have to the process of attachment, an unspeakable stream of causes is always created, stemming from the hope and fear that we have. And even when there is a wish to be free from samsara, yet causes will continuously create a string of events that will keep us in samsara. So therefore, it's important because it is the only way that sustains your confidence. And where the confidence is stronger and stronger, given more time, given much more protection and foundation to sustain itself, then there is the possibility for you to not be so enslaved by actual, to not be so pulled in by the magnetic power of the call to make hope and fear very, very real for oneself. So recognize that, and as I said earlier, following the footsteps of our great teachers, and therefore, as you are in retreat, wherever you are, work, practicing well, practicing it correctly, and along with it, also, I think, committing yourself to not just doing some retreat per year, but to really have a discipline of retreat in the coming years so that you can all deepen your understanding of the Dharma and see of many teachings that you have received, many transmissions that you have received, has a chance to be planted in your own mind, to be cared for, to be nurtured, so that the fruition of irreversible confidence of your own basic nature can truly bring about the realization of yourself and free all consciousness from samsara. So with that hope and prayer, do your retreat. I wish you all well, and I will look forward to seeing you all in the next retreat and cut this dearly. And in this way, age, there's tremendous, tremendous power in the prayers of all teachers that will truly bring about your mind to be creation with the essence of Dharma, with the enlightenment. And so, I'm very, very appreciative of all of you practicing and dedicating yourself to the art of practice. I'm fully aware of all the difficulties that you all do have, the practical difficulties that you all have. But samsara is not easy, and we all know that. And where you have been fighting with it and struggling to sustain it for so long, a little bit more work is hard in something so valuable as realization of the meaning of the Dharma. I think it's needed, and we will all do it. I've been doing it, and continue to do it, of that I'm very sure. And for that effort, very, very appreciative. And of course, I'm very appreciative to the Lopins, both Jan and Baba, worked very hard, and all the other Lopins who will be helping in the future retreat programs, and of course, to all my very, very good friends and members of the Lotus Garden Sangha, which is the residents who have worked very hard, and of course to Jetsanda, thank you very much. And I hope your continued days of retreat go without obstacles, and after the retreat, you're able to sustain the experience until you enter into your next retreat again. So it's all my love, all my good wishes. I'm going to say bye-bye for now.